All right, so I'm also going to be talking about ecosystem services of urban soils, but I'm going to be a little bit more specific, and I'm going to be focusing in on trees and how we could possibly make a better soil to promote tree growth and longevity, and then capture those benefits that trees provide us in the urban environment. So this research was a combination, work done through many students, actually. So Jacob Serminar, who is a pointer and now moved on, Katie Klaus, University of Illinois, and Kirsten Triller, who's at University of Northwestern, have all contributed on this, and I want to thank them, and they are co-authors on this presentation. All right. Okay, so what I'm going to cover are, what are engineered urban soils, why do we use them, first off, what they are, and then some of the research that we've been conducting towards making a better engineered urban soil. Okay, so why use them, first off? Well, so we, in the urban environment, in regards to trees, we obviously have this conflict, okay? We need to, the soils need to be suitable to support infrastructure, yet they also need to be suitable to support trees. And the conditions or that would support the infrastructure are quite a bit different than those ideal conditions that would support the trees, right? So we oftentimes are either going into a site and compacting that site if it was a natural soil, and we might be dramatically altering it and thus decreasing its function in relation to supporting trees. And this is an example of an arboretum in Shanghai in which they were going in and doing some recent construction, and I suspect that's going to have quite a negative impact on these soils. And these are natural soils, so these are not engineered soils. So compaction is a big issue, and it's a big issue for trees. So this is, again, a natural site in which we're not using an engineered soil, in which the site was compacted in order to make it suitable for infrastructure, and these trees have struggled on the site for quite some time. So this is one of our research sites in suburban Chicago, in which they've gone through three plantings already on this site of different trees, and each of these trees have died. So they've lived for 5-10 years and they die. They live for 5-10 years and they die. So the folks put a lot of resources into these sites for the trees, but they're just never going to make it because these soils are so compacted. So in a lot of instances, these natural soils are not going to be suitable. So that's why we're looking at these other soils. And on the other end of that spectrum, if we were to use these natural soils and not compact them, okay, well, that's going to make them unsuitable for infrastructure. And we're going to get problems like cracking here. So this is a foundation cracking from a site that we looked at near Fort Hood, Texas, in which the soils were not probably compacted to 95% Proctor density. Okay? All right, so that's leading into these engineered urban soils, why they're important. And I'm going to talk really specific now. So I'm talking about soils in the downtown environment, which are highly urbanized soils, supporting sidewalks, buildings, roads, and also trees. Okay, so that's the context we want to think about. Okay, so what are the engineered urban soils? I'd say they fall into three different categories. The sand-based, rock-based, and also soils that are probably a little bit more natural, with have some sort of suspension or support system to support the infrastructure. Okay, so first these sand-based structural soils. And these are probably our earliest engineered urban soils. And from my literature search, I found that these really popped up in Amsterdam. That's where they kind of start. That's where they became popular, and they were used quite a bit. And they actually called the Amsterdam sand-based soil. Okay, so these are pure sand, usually an ASTM A33, really washed sand of all the same size. Okay, so that sand, you can compact it, and you can also have some porosity to get the drainage, and the roots could potentially grow through that soil. Okay, and you're not going to have issues with subsidence and those results and those effects that would have on foundation. Sometimes you might have some compost in there. Oftentimes you do not. Okay, so that's one type of sand-based structural soils. And obviously, in a pure sand soil, that's going to be quite a challenging environment for trees, right? We're going to have issues with water-holding capacity, with nutrient supply. Okay, so we think they're, and people have found them to be very suitable for infrastructure. What about trees? Okay, and here's an example of some of these sand-based installations. So this is a picture from Boston. This is the Rose Kennedy Greenway, and all underneath this is all sand-based structural soil. Okay, and it does a great job at supporting the infrastructure. And here's what the soil looks like. And in this case, there is a little bit of organic amendment incorporated in, There's some compost incorporated in it at the time, and then there's a mulch layer. So there's a potential to build up some organic matter, a potential to make these soils hold some water, but I will say that this site is heavily irrigated. And without that irrigation, these trees would not be living on this site. Okay, so highly managed. Second category, rock-based structural soils. Okay, so these became popular, and there's a patent that came out of Cornell. Jason Grabowski and Nina Basick made a rock-based structural soil that became very popular for trees called the CU soil. And in the CU soil, they use gravel or coarse aggregates, and they usually use a polymer with that, and that polymer adheres to the aggregates, and that is supposed to hold on to the soil. And we're talking about volumes of soil, maybe 5-10% or so. So rocks with a little bit of soil in them, and maybe a little bit of compost with that. Okay? So you can envision this is also going to be a very challenging soil for holding on to water and nutrients and supporting trees, but a very good soil for supporting infrastructure. And out in Boston, these are planted quite a bit as well. This is an image from the Nichols Library in Boston, and an image of that CU soil underneath the infrastructure. Okay, and this soil has about 10%, or this substrate has about 10% soil, and the rocks are about yay. Okay, and oftentimes these sands and rocks are mixed. Okay, this is Central Wharf Plaza in Boston, and here we have a mix of a sand-based and a rock-based soil. So we have a rock-based soil on top and a sand-based soil underneath, and here's a zoom-in of it. But I'd say the majority of that substrate is indeed sand-based. Okay? All right, and then the last category of these engineered urban soils, I'd say, are the suspended pavement approach. Okay, and these are probably going to be something a little bit more natural soil, and we're not relying on the soil to support the infrastructure. We're relying on the infrastructure to support the infrastructure. Okay? And an example, again, from Boston. Here's Christian Science Center. Anybody been here seen these trees? Really awesome planting. Really beautiful trees. The soil underneath there, we investigated this. So this is about a 60-year-old site, and it had argillic horizon in it. Okay, so we actually saw some natural soil formation going on in here. And those trees, the quality of those trees was certainly reflected in this. Okay, but there are problems with this suspended soil. It can often be very expensive, and there's maintenance issues with it. Okay, so those Boston pictures, that was part of a kind of an observational study we did a few years back, and we wanted to get relative quality of trees growing in these different substrates. The Gleditzia pictured there on your left there is quite chlorotic. The sick tree and the good tree, and the pin oak is from Post Office Square, also in Boston, and this is more of a natural soil or a suspended soil. And we saw that across all of these environments. We surveyed quite a few of the Boston sites, and we looked at a bunch of different indices for tree quality. So these are just three metrics to qualitatively assess tree condition. And we found that, as you'd probably expect, if we're able to provide these trees a little bit more natural-looking soil, they did well, and it was reflected in their condition. Okay? If you're curious, so there's also a whole bunch of these engineered urban soils all around the conference center. Okay? And from what I can gather just by poking around and digging up, pulling up some of these crates, they're more of a suspended soil, and underneath that suspension, there's a rock and sand-based mix. So if you want to look around, I encourage you to do so. And I noticed the trees, they don't look very healthy. Okay, these trees they don't require a lot of water, and they actually have matched the site conditions to the substrate quality for the vast majority. There's a lot of the Palo Verde tree planted in the city, but when you have a tree that requires a little bit more water around the conference center, you can see that they're expressing conditions of stress, such as this one right here. All right, so in summary, the problem is that these sand-based soils, although and rock-based soils, they do support infrastructure quite well. They don't provide nutrients and water. And the suspended infrastructure can be quite expensive. So is there a solution, something we can work towards as a compromise? And that's what we've been looking at in a research context. Okay, so we're hoping that we can work towards developing an engineered urban soil specifically better suited to support trees and also some other ecosystem services. And I'll talk specifically about nutrient leaching as the ecosystem service we were interested in assessing. Okay, and an idea with the tree soil, so this was developed through some collaboration and consultation with landscape architects. So I work, this research was actually funded by a group of landscape architects through the ASLA, and we've gotten input from them on what they think would be a reasonable mix that they could actually use in these landscapes. And then our contribution was, okay, how can we increase the water and nutrient holding capacity? And our idea and what we tested in this research is a soil that we're backing off on the sand and we're increasing the natural soil, and the natural soil that we're including in this mix, we're not screening. Okay, so that's the standard practice right now is you go collect a bunch of soil or you move a soil from another landscape and you pass it through a 3/8 inch screen, okay, because they want some uniformity. Well, we think, and the landscape architects that I've talked to, we think that they can get some buy-in with keeping these coarse aggregates in there. And we think these coarse aggregates are going to be really important in terms of creating some strength in that soil and also providing some additional, maybe carbon sequestration, some porosity. Okay, so that's the prescription we're testing. I'll give you more details on that. All right, so we've conducted four experiments on this. I'm only going to talk about two of them. The first one's looking at substrates. The second one's looking at substrates and amendments. The third one's looking at this approach for a green roof. And I have a student, Simon Stevenowski. Simon, you're here? There he is. Simon's got a poster. So if you're interested, go see Simon's poster. And then the last experiments by a student, Miles, and I don't have any data on that. All right, so this experiment. So the tree soil. So we looked at Tilia shamrock. We have three different soil types. We have a sand soil, we have a native, and a tree soil, and I'll give you more details on that. All the trees were planted in these mesocosms, 75 liters or so, and we have 11 replicates, and we also included two different cover types. A mulched with a wood chip, or we left the surface bare. Okay, the soil that was used in the components here is an Ozaki silt loam. So we're talking about a soil with about 20% sand and about 60% silt and about 20% clay. pH of about 7-ish. Okay, and it's a haplodelph, oxyacric. Okay, and that's a picture of our research plot. Okay, so our native soil. And this was a comparison to get what trees might look like in a reference soil. That was that 100% Ozaki soil, okay? And it was compacted to 95% Proctor density, okay? So smushed. Our urban soil, so what's the traditional, this is the standard practice today. So standard practice, high sand soil, so 60% sand, 15% compost, and then 25% of the Ozaki that is highly screened to a 3/8 inch. And then our tree soil, here we flip the proportions of natural soil and sand, and we're also allowing for larger aggregates, okay? And all of those were compacted to 95% Proctor. Okay, the trees. So the trees were tortured before planted. We cut all their root systems to uniformity, and we did this because that's what's typically done in the landscape, and we wanted to induce some stress. Okay, so we trimmed all the root systems. We also trimmed all the shoots. We measured diameter and marked them so we could go back and figure relative diameter growth rates. And then biomass was determined before we stuck them in the pots. Okay, the soils were mixed on site. They were compacted in the mesocosms, and we did it in a series of three lifts. And this field Proctor thing that we have set up was correlated with the Proctor test that we did in the laboratory. So this legematic here. All right, after we put in our first lift, we planted the trees and put two more lifts on top of that, and those lifts were compacted as well, too. And then just some pictures of our three different types, the sand, tree, and native soil. So, and this is without the mulch covering, these three examples. We did some in-situ measurements. We looked at surface respiration using a LIQOR, soil moisture, soil temperature, and I'll present some of that data. All right, so this is a table of the p-values of the response parameters we looked at in this study, soil and the effects of soil, cover, and also the interactions of soil by cover. Okay, and you can see that we did have quite a few significant responses in regards to the soil type, and we had a few in response to the cover type. And I'm going to focus mostly on the soil type, and I'll talk about the interactions when they're important. Okay, So first and foremost, and probably not surprising, our strongest response was indeed related to soil moisture. Okay, so every point throughout our sampling period, this was, we found significant differences amongst our three types. So the native soil always had more moisture compared to the tree soil, which always had more moisture, to the sand soil. And each one of those were significantly different from each other. And then a mean volumetric moisture content across the entire sampling date, we saw that we had about 15% more moisture in our native compared to our sand, and about 10% more moisture in our tree compared to our sand. And that became really important when we started looking at the tree responses. Water is really important in these soils. Okay, our second thing that was quite responsive was organic matter. And this is pretty obvious. We included more soil in the tree soils, and that soil had organic matter contents about 2% organic carbon. So it had a good amount of carbon in it. And we also think that we were promoting biological activity, and I'll get to that in a bit, so that restitution, thank you, Susan, would also be increasing that soil organic matter. Okay, surface respiration. So this is using the LIPOR measurements. We found significantly greater surface respiration in our tree soil compared to our native soil. And we think that our native soil, maybe that your carbon was a little bit more protected. Okay, and that's why we think that our sand soil is in the middle there. So we probably had a little bit more oxidation of the carbon of the compost as we mix it into the sand there. Okay. And then the other measurements, which I don't have graphs for, but I'll show you some data. We did look at high summer temperatures and low winter temperatures, as we thought maybe that sand soil might lead to really low temperatures that might potentially kill trees, but we didn't see that. We did see a significant decrease in our bulk density in our tree compared to our sand, and our pH was higher with our sand, and also our electroconductivity was higher with our sand. Okay. We didn't see much in tree responses, and this is one of the response parameters. We looked at stomatal conductance, and these are the p-values for the various tree measurements. And you can see we had no significant responses by soil type. This is over one growing season, okay? So we weren't expecting anything groundbreaking, but I was actually hoping to see something significant. What I do think is going on here, and this is the important take-home that I do think we can conclude from this, if we look at stomatal conductance, and actually if we focus in on an area of the growing season for stomatal conductance, later in the growing season, when it was very dry, we found that the tree soil stomatal conductance was significantly greater than the urban soil. So that's important because it told us that in these periods of stress, that tree soil appeared to allow the tree to stay photosynthetically active. And I suspect if we were to carry this experiment over a couple more growing seasons, we might actually see that translate into biomass. All right, so that was our conclusions from our first experiment, and it kind of led to what can we do next? How can we improve the tree soil? And how we're trying to improve the tree soil is by adding different organic amendments like biosolids and biochar. Okay. The biosolids that we used in the second experiment, these are EPA Class A certified. So Sally mentioned the different classes. So they do not have contaminant levels in them. They're very high in nitrogen and phosphorus. And we're hoping that the biosolids would contribute some nutrients. In addition to the biosolids, we're adding biochar. So the biochar we used is a woody feedstock biochar, pyrolysis temperatures of about 400 to 600 degrees Celsius. And this was made from mountain pine beetle slash out west. And the idea of incorporating the biochar with the biosolids is we're hoping that the biochar would hold on to some of the nutrients. Okay, so we're adding nutrients with the biosolids and hoping to hold them with the biochar. Okay, so some of the things that we found in the second experiment. So here we see significant effects on respiration, water, and leachates. Okay, and I'll talk about them in more detail now. Okay, so diameter growth. So with the native soil, we saw significantly greater diameter growth so far. We still have one more year to collect data here, and our tree soil is somewhere in between there. Okay. With relative diameter growth by the treatments now, we can see across all of our soil types, we were getting significantly greater biomass or growth in our combination treatments in comparison to our null treatment, and also in comparison to our biochar alone. Okay, so both soil type and treatment have an effect here, and they also have an interaction effect. Okay, so the the trend's similar across all three soil types. The question is, can we improve the tree soil? So focusing on the middle graph, and with the biochar and the biosolids, it appears that we did get significantly greater growth compared to our null. So can we improve the tree soil by adding biochar and biosolids? It appears so. Okay, some of the in-situ measurements, respiration and water content. We saw significantly greater water content with the combination treatment compared to the null. And we also saw, just like in our first study, we saw the same pattern with volumetric water content being highest in our native, lowest in our sand soil. Okay, respiration also had a significant effect of the biochar and biosolids, so we were promoting biological activity with that treatment. And we saw our greatest surface respiration with our sand and tree. So kind of similar to what we found in the first experiment there. All right, so leachates, this is what I want to spend just a little bit, a few minutes on, because this was the other ecosystem benefit. So we collected leachates in these containers. They were collected every time it rained, every time we got leachate in there. And we computed some means over the growing season. So we have nitrates, nitrogen in year one and year two, and we have phosphates, P in year one and year two, and this is by our soil types. So we had significantly greater nitrate in the first year with our native and tree, and we think that this is in response to the higher organic matter contribution of those soils at the beginning, and that dropped off quite a bit in our second year. Okay, whereas the sand soil, we still saw that pulse of nitrate. Okay, and we think that's probably as a result of the sand's limited ability to hold on to nitrate. Okay, with phosphates, we saw the same trend both years, in which we had a significantly higher release of phosphate in our sand soil compared to our others. And then if we look at that by our treatments, the question here was, hopefully, we were hoping that we would see the combination biochar and biosolids, a significant decrease in NNP, and we did not see that. So it didn't appear that the biochar was able to hold on to the nitrate or the phosphate. So we're testing this further. All right, so we do think that the biochar and biosolids improve tree growth. Thank you. We did see rather high nutrient leaching with our sand-based soil and also with our combination treatments and those that include the biosolids. But we think we might be able to get around that while testing other biochars. The biochar we used had really coarse particles, so we're exploring maybe a smaller particle size. All right, and our conclusion is that tree soil with about 60% topsoil, unscreened, inclusion of biosolids and biochar seems to be a good starting point, and we're going to be doing further research to see if this can be a good recommendation for folks to install. So thanks to those folks, thanks to Jacob, Kristen, the students that helped out, and if you have questions, I'd be happy to take them. Yes, sir. Yeah, we have at the Morton Arboretum, where I'm a research fellow, we have a very old permeable paver parking lot that's been installed, and we did a study on looking at the contribution those trees have to the water budget in that system, and we found it was quite significant. But we haven't looked at amending soils underneath permeable pavements with these different products. Susan?
I have a question. Did you measure soil strength in the treatments? And I'm also wondering,
sure. So the question is in regards to soil strength and the ability to support infrastructure. So we measured bulk density afterwards, and the next steps for this research is to explore that a little bit more. Is it going to continue to support infrastructure? We did find that we started with a bulk density of about 1.6, 1.55 or so, and then after 2 years, that bulk density dropped to about 1.23-ish. Okay, so it dropped quite a bit. And that's definitely a concern, so we're looking at that. Now we definitely need to verify that it can also support infrastructure. how we develop that prescription is working with landscape architects, though. Given the materials that they have and the constraints they have, we wanted to have that input from the practitioner side. Yeah, in the back. Have I looked at how to discourage trees? I have. No. I do not want to discourage trees. I have not. Folks have, though. Yeah. Gary Watson at the Morton Arboretum looked at root inhibitors for that. Yes? Well, I think that the first year with that nitrate, I think it's just a little bit more mobile. Okay, so it flushed out. Whereas the phosphate, I don't know. Those systems are pretty leaky. You saw the values are quite high. So I don't really trust that first year's data, actually. So, well, I'm moderating, so I think I got to move on. So.